It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Hello,
you Sam.
What is this? Go home. Go away.
I was going to wittily contrive some humor for the intro again, you know, talking again.
Stuff like this is why Brexit happened, Anthony. All right, let's go. Hello, so Anthony said at the end of the last pod that this episode would be picking over the wreckage of Game Week 3. And wow, was he ever correct. One hell of a wild ride culminated in tonight's 3-1 Liverpool victory over Arsenal, which left many managers seething in an unreal outpouring of emotion which we saw across social media. So this week, as advertised, we will be picking over the said wreckage and trying to make some sense of the madness. One man, however, who did benefit a bit from the madness, as you'll hear in the game reviews, is Nick. You all right, mate?
Hey, Tom. My benefactor this game week was party man Jamie Vardy, the man who defies statistics, sticks his middle finger up to people who talk about non-pen XG and all of that, and bangs in a hat-trick. Still, it felt like a little bit of a one-man party considering the wreckage of everyone else's game weeks. Just to say who we are, of course we are Who Got the Assist, and you know that already, but you can find us on Twitter, or if you haven't followed us on Instagram as well, we're wgta.fpl. And welcome, of course, to all new listeners. Make sure to hit subscribe if you like what you hear and join our mini league as well, which has the code CPSULF. So, Anthony, how are you?
That's great to be back again. One hell of a week, but we got through it. We can go again. Game week 4 will arrive in a few days' time. And it will be better than this one, presumably.
Hopefully.
Anyway. Look, we'll move on to the agenda for this episode. So we spoke about it after game week 1, but a ludicrous set of penalties this week have brought 12-yard spot kicks to the fore even more than before. So we're going to go back for a second helping, but from a different angle so that we're not repeating ourselves. If you want to get more info than what you get today, go back 2 episodes. Not only were there many penalties, though, there was also plenty of tears with low scores the norm across the board as the template faltered again. So we're going to discuss how to react to this sort of week. And in a pretty jam-packed first segment, we'll also question what conclusions we can draw about teams and whether any of them are giving us cause for optimism after 3 game weeks. After the break, the league update, everyone's favourite section, correspondence. We've actually received a record number of emails to whogottheassist@gmail.com this week.
Hey.
And we're going to finish off the pod with the Q&A and our transfers and captains.
Perfect. All right, let's get the game review out of the way. We can both get up and walk off when Nick starts talking, Anthony.
Yeah.
I'll start first. I netted out with 36 after my minus 8, so that's 44 minus 8. I'm actually not too annoyed about it. I know that people might look at it and kind of think, oh, you know, that was a terrible decision, blah, blah, blah. Actually, no, I think my team's in good shape going forward. And crucially, because it was such a bad week for everybody, I feel like I've effectively hidden that sort of mini course correction within the context of quite a poor one for everybody on math. Stars for me, McCarthy got the clean sheet finally. Luke Ayling, Mo Salah and Trent tonight got assists. I think Trent's on for 3 bonus as we speak. And Richarlison was unveiled as the Everton pen taker. But, you know, apart from that, De Bruyne, a spectacular blank, City imploded. And the hilarious sort of moment of the game week where Raul Jimenez deflected in a Thomas Suchek header. Suchek actually benched him this week for Anguissa from Fulham, so I can make Zamboni references. So Suchek's on the bench with 6 points, and Jimenez came in as part of that minus eight. The other one coming in was KDB. So Jimenez got an own goal and got zero just to round things off, which is absolutely ridiculous. I'm down to 1.4 or whatever, 1.5 million. But at the end of the day, my team's looking very good for next week. Maybe I could look at Martial and think I'd get rid of him, but I think I'm probably going to leave it. I've successfully hidden the minus eight. No, it wasn't a good week. I'm not going to try to qualify it and insult all of your intelligences. How did you do, Anthony?
So that's a pretty optimistic take from you, Tom. Even though I got 46 points gross, 42 net, I'm not feeling as optimistic as you are. The Werner captaincy didn't work out, and that felt very bad at the time. But watching De Bruyne get 2 points, Aubameyang, who I'd sold, get 2 points, Salah only getting 5, softened that blow to some extent. I guess the more annoying thing is that I had taken a hit late in the week after the Gabriel Jesus news came out to bring in Phil Foden for Thomas Suchek, who actually got an attacking return, which would have been very helpful in my team. And Phil Foden obviously got nothing. So Cadham, Penalty Wilson and Richarlison getting 8 points each was helpful. Salah's assist and the Alexander-Arnold points as well kind of hauled me along with his assist and 3 bonus in spite of getting a yellow card, pretty much proving vital to me on the route to getting 42. Ramsdale as well got 4 points, which could have been 11 points if he wasn't so rudely robbed of his clean sheet quite late on by Patrick Bamford. So I feel I'm going to wildcard soon. The plan was always to do it after game week 4 as we went into the international break, and I think I'll hold on long enough. The problem is that a lot of the players who I would have been selling to avoid price drops, they've already dropped now, the likes of Matt Doherty, for example. So I don't feel the same need to get on with it as I maybe would have done otherwise. So I'll hang on, do my best, but overall not too happy with the way things have gone. But at the same time, since everyone has done poorly, it's not the worst in the world. 1.4 mil-ish overall rank.
Yeah, a good week to have a bad game week. But one man who hasn't had a bad game week, and we're about to storm off in a flouncing fashion, is Nick. How did you do?
Wait, sorry, look, bye.
I'll see you later, guys. Yeah,
no, yeah,
I got 63 points this week. Did take a minus four, so it's 59 net.
What are you even here for, Nick?
Jeez. So yeah, it was a bad start. Captain fail at the beginning. Timo Werner got me 2x2, so that was a bit of a dodgy start. But you know, the defence did pretty well. McCarthy got a clean sheet and goal. Luke Eiling got 7 points. Luca Dean picked up 6. Trent's got 3 bonus, so he got 7. In midfield, Podence, who I brought in on the minus four, joined that wagon. That didn't work out because he was injured. Didn't play, so I ended up having Mitchell come off the bench for 1 point. And also brought in De Bruyne, who got 2 points. So that wasn't great either. But Salah got an assist. And Suchek also returned, which was very nice. And of course, the main man, the man who brought all my points, most of my points, was Jamie Vardy. 17 points up front, the party man himself. So overall, kind of recovered a little bit compared to like the shocker that I had in game week 2, kind of a little bit back on track. So that's pleasing to see. And I guess it's, you know, for those that are depressed about this particular game week, it only takes another game week and all of a sudden you're back on top again. So don't panic too much.
Oh yeah, well done, Nick. I think as you said in the very first pod, there's a reason why you had Jamie Vardy, and yeah, it's absolutely proved. 5 goals, 0.25, I think it is, MPXG. Absolutely brilliant. Goals are goals, as we've said many times. Right, moving on to the market forces then, the movers and shakers this week. What's going on? How's the market initially reacted to what we've seen?
Zero price rises yesterday, but 18 players dropping in value shows that there's not really any standout picks because of the sporadic form of many of the FPO assets right now. But there's a few forwards that have caught the eye of many managers. So Calvert-Lewin, he's currently the most transferred in forward right now, 317,000 transfers in for him. Of course, he has 5 goals now in 3 games. So great start for him, great start for Everton in general, who have looked really good so far this season. Lots of managers jumping on that wagon. He's now risen to, he's 7.4 million. He's probably going to rise again in the next couple of days as well. So a lot of people jumping on him. It's also Vardy, 163,000 transfers in. He is yellow flagged at the moment, because he did have a bit of a groin injury near the end of the game. So that's perhaps preventing a few more from jumping on him. But West Ham and Aston Villa at home up next. Both of those teams just had amazing game week. They both just absolutely annihilated their opponents, didn't they? And the other forwards, fourth most transferred in player is Patrick Bamford. So we keep saying, when is this run of goals going to stop for Bamford? You know, he's defying the statistics, but maybe he isn't. Who knows? He could be the next Vardy, the next Danny Ings. He's got 3 goals and 2 assists to his name in 3 fixtures so far. And lots of managers jumping on him as well. 150,000 transfers in. Now 22.1% owned and 5.7 million.
Yeah, it's quite crazy actually looking at the DCL numbers. Like, he's the second most transferred in player in any position, is over basically half of, has about half as many transfers in as him. So it's pretty substantial how far ahead he is. And I guess the yin to his yang is Timo Werner being sold by 350-ish K managers. That's the second consecutive time that he's been in the topping the list for transfers out for attackers. And he actually has bigger sales now on Monday night recording than he did by Tuesday of last week, showing just how annoyed people are by him blanking against West Brom. Tony Martial is second in this, and that's the second time he's been in this featured here consecutively as well, as one of the most transferred out forwards, along with Raul Jimenez.
Otherwise, in terms of defenders, Cassano, he's the third most transferred in player right now, 160,000 transfers in. So Leicester's fixtures, as I said, turning a little bit of a corner on paper at least. And he's already got 3 assists and 1 goal to his name as well. So people loving the attacking defender there. It looks like our good friend Matt Doherty is the one that's making way for him for many a team. He's the fourth most transferred out player right now and the highest defender for transfers out, with 67,000 transfers out. And finally, in the midfielders, so Son, he had a hamstring injury, unfortunately. He's the most transferred out player right now. 400,000 transfers out for him. In terms of the midfielders, few catching the eye. No one really sticking out. James Rodriguez blanked this week, but he's the most transferred in midfielder with 157,000 transfers in. Zaha, another player that also blanked, also being transferred in. He's got 130,000 transfers in at time of recording.
A few striking things there, actually. Matt Doherty, it's the third consecutive week he's been the most transferred out defender. Son was by far the most transferred in player last week, and now he's going to be probably by far the most transferred out player this week. And yeah, it is just that James Rodriguez, I guess, in spite of blanking, coming along there as the most transferred in midfielder, shows, I guess, along with the Dominic Calvert-Lewin popularity, that really people are buying into Everton and almost no other team in terms of performances so far this year.
Certainly, but it sounds like the hokey-cokey really is in the forwards at the moment, which kind of makes sense, doesn't it, of how things have gone. Cool, right, let's move on to the main sort of talking point this week. So as Anthony mentioned in the kickoff, there's kind of 3 things we'll be looking at, which is kind of pen updates, pens revisited, how to react to a bad game. We can finally, is anyone any good? Basically. But this all comes under the overarching umbrella of the key question: how do we make sense of the madness? So obviously it's been quite a tough start to the season, and you know, maybe the tale of Son Heung-min being the most sold player, then the most bought player, then the most sold player encapsulates that very, very nicely. In terms of making sense of the madness first, I mean, we did get there first with the penalties, luckily, did that in game week one, and I wryly remarked then, God, we don't do this again. We might have to have a look at it, though, I think. Just to give an update, the state of the nation, the state of the pen nation, fantasy penalty league, to coin an original phrase, to see where we are. And basically where we are is that there's been 20 penalties in 28 games. That's 0.71 penalties per game, extrapolated for the 480 games this season. That's 269.8 penalties. Unfeasible, but still absolutely mad, the rate that we're seeing them. For context, last season, 20 penalties were conceded by the time we got to game week 11. So it's game week 3 this year, game week 11 last year. That was Gerald De La Feu's penalty for Watford in the Lundstram brace week. So that would have been November the 2nd. So yeah, we're quite a long way ahead of last year already in terms of penalty awards. And this year as well, it's worth noting, there have been 6 handball penalties. There were 0 at this point last year. There's definitely been a sea change, as we've all seen, all remarked on. There have been lots of kind of debates, lots of kind of moaning about basically the situation with VAR, the rules, etc., etc. I mean, Anthony, you were the man who was ringing the death knell of rationality, perhaps, surrounding penalties. What do you think is going to happen next?
while we're trying to keep as strictly on FPL as possible, I think it's important just to deal with the debate for just a second, because some of the takes about VAR and about referees have been frankly ludicrous. You'll find them on any television station or on any Twitter timeline near you. Where a player makes their body unnaturally bigger and handles the ball, where the hand is considered to be any part of the arm below the armpit, that is going to be a handball foul in the if it's in the box, defensive handball, penalty. Now, it seems that any extension of the arms from the body, and that's like anything other than the arms against the body in your classic pencil dive, or where your hands are behind your back, anything other than those could amount to making the body unnaturally bigger. There is no room for the referees to apply common sense to this rule. They can't go over to the VAR screen and go, oh, mate, he didn't mean it. No, there isn't space for that. Especially if you put your hands above your head like Eric Dyer did, that's an explicit no-no in the rules as well. It doesn't matter if he couldn't have known where the ball is or that he clearly didn't mean it. That does not matter. There is no leeway for common sense for the referees in this. Now, you tried to blame VAR for this. That's not fair either, because to blame VAR just is not correct. The rules have been carefully clarified in a way so that the answer to what is a penalty is easily worked out, so that every referee in every game can apply the rule in the same way all the time. There are obvious benefits that come from that sort of certainty in the regulations and equal application in all circumstances. But yes, it also has created a situation where the results of games can hinge completely on micro infractions of the handball rule that are so fast or so minor that a referee would never spot them with the naked eye. Hell, even the team who are calling for the penalty may not realize that they should have had a penalty in the first place. But that is the way it is. It is not the rule that is stupid. You can't blame a speed camera for speed limits. You can't blame VAR for the handball rule. People need to kind of get over that. Now, when it comes to talk about reform, that's pie in the sky stuff. Persistence with frustrating rules has been a feature of the VAR era. For example, the armpit offsides. What we've seen is that our understandings of rules become clearer. The rollout of the rule improves as well. Like we don't see the zany lines on our screens anymore. We move on. That's going to happen with penalties too. There's also evidence from Germany, and this is what's going to be continually pointed to, where the current handball rule has operated there for two full seasons. And I've adjusted these numbers to deal with the German 340-game season versus the Premier League's 380-game season. But basically, in year one, German handball penalties doubled from 19 to 38. In year two, handball pens awarded went straight back down to the old level to 19. So defenders basically adapted their behaviour. Defenders are going to just have to get used to not putting their hands above their head as they jump. They're going to have to get used to defending with their hands behind their back. And this is just here to stay. The game isn't gone. The rule's here to stay.
I did comment after, I think it was a Joel Ward one, that there's maybe if you were a cynical manager, you may kind of be charging your players just to aim for the hand in the area. But as you say, the rules are here to stay.
But and Tom, I've played field hockey for years, and a feature of field hockey is that if you hit the ball against someone's foot, you get a foul. If it's in the D, you get a thing called a short corner. And the fact of the matter is, that's just how the game is played. I don't think football is going to go that way, because you can actually put your hands behind your back. You can't. The problem with hockey is you can't lift your feet up and levitate. So it stays as a feature. It's going to be fine. But yes, yeah, it will be, of course, a tactic for a bit.
I think it's probably just, it is magnified, isn't it, by social media. And people love to jump on the bandwagon, especially if it's a bandwagon of outrage and a bandwagon of change. And I'm not going to go into this because that's not what we're here to talk about. But I broadly agree with you there. But let's move on to the FPL ramifications, because after all, that's what we're here to talk about. And Billy the Kid, aka FPL Dougal, asked a good question here, because obviously it's been everywhere. Like, how are we going to do this? I saw, you know, FPL General did something like this, FPL Heisenberg, something like this, just popped up, you know, a front eight of all penalty-taking players or something like that. Like, is that a viable thing, do we think? I mean, Nick, is it all about the pen takers now? What's your opinion on that?
I think there's actually quite a lot of correlation in terms of the assets that we're looking at anyway, and whether they're penalty takers or not. I think certainly I look at the players that I'm targeting right now as a replacement for Werner, who's probably going to be leaving my team, and I'm looking at Jimenez and Ings, and it's just a factor, and it's a very positive factor in their favour, of course. It's just a factor that they both take penalties for their team. So Danny Ings is on penalties for Southampton, Jimenez is on penalties for Wolves. And that is something, of course, that I do need to consider, especially considering what has been happening in the last few game weeks and how we've seen the rule change has affected the Premier League. So it's not the be-all and end-all of FPL. It's not going to morph into fantasy penalty league where we only look at the penalty takers, you know, and screw the rest of our team. There's going to be players that do emerge at their clubs that aren't necessarily on penalties that we're going to consider, of course. But, you know, based on current evidence and based on what we've seen so far, I think when you're making your transfers, it is something that certainly is going to be at the forefront of most FPL managers' minds right now, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I did a little bit of work on this just to test that out a little bit, because you said there's a correlation, there's an overlap between people who are on pens and people would be targeting anyway. So to do this, I ran the list of penalty takers through Talisman Theory, basically. And the idea behind that, of course, Talisman Theory, that is, if you're not familiar, is that you should target the key FPL point scorers in teams and your transfers in. And the overlap is pretty striking. So Arsenal's Talismans were Bamiangos for the pen taker, Villa, Grealish, pen taker, Morpay, Brighton, pen taker, Burnley Wood, pen taker, and so on and so forth. Basically, 13 out of 17 clubs' talisman are also the pen taker. Throw in Pukki and Deeney from last year, and you've got 15 out of 20. And two clubs, Man United's Bruno and Newcastle Wilson, you'd expect them to be the talisman anyway. So basically, what it boils down to is that the pen taker already tends to be the best FPL asset on the team anyway. So it could be said that looking at pen takers is, you know, a brand new way of looking at FPL and changes the zeitgeist and changes the models that that dictate what we should be looking at, but that's not true at all. Basically, buying pen takers isn't insight at all. It's just reframing the oldest bit of advice in the book, which is buy the best FPL players. As you said in Game Week 1 on the penalties pod, it's a bonus measure which amplifies the points potential of players who already have high points potential through penalties. Historically, I suppose, Talisman and pen takers are basically the same thing. Good players and pen takers are basically the same thing.
It's quite interesting that, actually, but it does make sense at the end of the day. It's usually the guys who get the goals that are the talisman, and usually the goal scorers are the ones that take the penalties. It's all quite logical. So to layer on top of all the research that we've already done, I've done further research with regards to penalties. So as we talked about it, that there have been only 20 penalties so far this season. Six of those were handball penalties. Estimates, we talked about a few weeks ago what the estimates were in terms of number of penalties, and we were expecting about 10 more handball pens to be awarded in the Premier League this season.
Yeah,
we're on course to break that number.
Yeah, six already.
Yeah, we're six already, and we would definitely break that 10. So I looked at penalties per match day in La Liga and Serie A last season, where they were implementing this rule. Five penalties per game week was pretty normal. And that rate didn't drop off as defenders adapted their behaviours or anything. Serie A game week 30 actually had 10 penalties in one game week. So that's one penalty per game. Basically, the idea behind all these algorithms was that there would be about 22% more penalties scored and awarded in the league. Now, we talked about the record being 106 a few weeks ago. If we were to put 22% onto 106, we're talking to about 129 penalties. And look, I guess that's possible. That would be a pretty big increase, but maybe that's the limit in this. I looked as well at penalty distribution across teams in Italy and Spain, in Serie A and La Liga. And what we don't have is some sort of conspiracy by FIFA and the higher-ups to protect the top teams. What we actually see is that there's a very mixed set of teams that are awarded the most penalties under this system. For example, in Italy, Lazio, who finished fourth, had 18. Genoa, who finished 17th, had 16. Lecce, who were relegated in 18th, had 15. Juventus, 14, who obviously won. And Roma, 14th, they finished 5th. La Liga, similar story. So this isn't a buy pen takers from the top teams. It's just, if you're thinking about pen takers, just because they're from a top team doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get more penalties. Though at the same time, if it's a team that has Wilfried Zaha in it, or a team like Manchester United, which has had a proven pedigree of winning penalties in the old system, Leicester the same, then of course you would think they're probably going to get more penalties than most teams anyway. But it certainly isn't a thing that, let's say, Newcastle will get very few penalties. No, they probably will get a few.
Cool. All right. Yeah. I saw what you mean. And but I guess again, it's kind of Pentakers and Talisman probably one in the same at the moment. I don't think we have any anomalies. Maybe Jorginho at Chelsea if he's still on them. Milivojevic at Crystal Palace. Ayu did take one, but he wasn't on the pitch, was he, Millie? But I think they're the only two anomalies in the league. The rest of the time, you don't have like a designated Pentaker. Doesn't offer anything else at this moment in time.
Is it Noble?
Yeah, maybe Noble. I think I don't know if Antonio would just be on them full stop now because Noble seems to have become like a bit part player.
There's some people are living in a pipe dream that Suchek would be the penalty taker as well. I saw he has pedigree. I was like, oh, okay, fair enough, man.
He did take penalties in the Czech Republic, indeed. That would obviously be ridiculous if so. But anyway, I think the key outtake, hopefully this is the last time we talk about penalties, is that penalty takers and penalties are here to stay as a factor in the Premier League. And I suspect that as the season rolls on, if the rate is sustained, as Anthony has suggested from other leagues, it may well be, and we're just going to have to get used to it. And maybe we'll see these sort of melodramatic outrages decrease and decline over time, a little bit at least. Just it will hopefully change next time PGMO or next time FIFA can have a look at it. But at the moment, it just looks like it's going to be how it's going to be. Right, let's take a break there and then move on to the second part of the first section, just to let that all sink in. Rats into a bad week.
Who got the assist?
Right, so we're back, and to continue our How Do You Make Sense of the Madness podcast, we've had a look at penalties. Pentakers here to stay. Get used to weird, VAR-y pen handball rule stuff. We're on to reacting to a bad week, because obviously this week there was outpouring of grief, anger, teenage angst on the timeline. It was basically like watching the episode of The OC, given some of the teenager sadness that I was seeing. But yeah, I mean, how do we react to a bad game week is probably a good one to talk about here. Daniel Mackey has asked, how do we recognise a good team that's had a bad week and a bad team in general? It's probably a good point to start here, I think, just because I think there's a lot of people kind of saying, oh, my team's actually terrible. You know, I've scored 20 points, 30 points. I think the reality is, if you're listening to this, you wouldn't be making bad decisions, really. You won't be making obvious errors like choosing defensive midfielders, putting Kante on your team or something. The majority of the time, I suspect you will just have a good team that's had a bad week. What do you guys reckon to that as a starter?
I'd agree with that exactly. When I read the question, I kind of phrased it in terms of actual football teams as opposed to your FPL team, but it kind of worked quite well with the fixture set that we saw this game week anyway. For instance, you might have Manchester City assets in your team and they obviously got thrashed 5-2. Doesn't suddenly turn Kevin De Bruyne into a bad player or a bad FPL pick. Same with Raheem Sterling. And you can say exactly the same for the Wolves team, who, you know, it was a freak result, essentially, losing 4-0 to West Ham. But it doesn't suddenly mean that Jimenez is going to be someone you've got to get rid of straight away, because he's got Fulham at home up next. And same with the Wolves' defence as well. They all got 0 points, didn't they? But you keep some faith in them, and they're probably going to return, hopefully, for you next week. So it doesn't suddenly make Wolves a bad team. We've been watching a couple of years now, and they've been brilliant in the Premier League, haven't they? And however, on the other side of the fence, you know, we are noticing a few trends. Fulham conceding 3 again tonight. You know, this is not a statistical anomaly. This is evidence that they are a bad team. They're probably going to struggle all season. And with that in mind, with your Wolves players, continue to own them and certainly target Fulham for next week.
I would say the Wolves result was an anomaly. And I think just given that it's Fulham up next, if they had a bad set of fixtures coming up, I might be saying something totally different. But when it's Fulham coming up, who are definitely worse than Wolves, I think there's no reason not to keep the faith. I think another maybe conclusion you can draw is that Sheffield United are going to struggle to score goals this season. They're just really lacking in that department. And Liverpool are still good. They've been consistently tipping away as well. So there are a few things that you can definitely look at in the league and not get too concerned about. And within your own side, I think provided there weren't injuries or something cataclysmic happening to your squad, you shouldn't really feel too much differently about them after a bad week. It's easy to panic. Like, a lot of people pulled their wild cards this week and still ended up with 30 or 40 points. That's all right. It was a really weird week. Basically, nobody's captain scored any points as well. And captains do pretty much help the average up by 10 points or 20 points a lot of the time anyway. So just hang on, it'll be okay, and just keep watching.
Just given our experience, we've all finished a lot of seasons, and Nick and I have certainly been doing this podcast for this is the fourth year, and obviously Anthony, you were dossing around before you came on board full time. Like,
I'm writing here for a year longer, I think.
Yeah, I mean, do you guys think our experience, or at least the time that we've spent on doing this, or being part of the FPL experience, as it were, has changed how we feel bad game weeks, do we still feel kind of the anger, the angst as strongly as some still evidently do? So I don't think I do. How do you guys take having a not great week?
So I thought I'd grown completely insulated to it over time. I think there was a stage where I kind of was attached some sort of importance to making sure I was able to, you know, be like, oh, another good week for, you know, your favorite FPL correspondent. And then that definitely died away during my first season on Twitter, which was a colossally poor season from me. That was the Leicester season, so 2015-16. And after that, I just kind of disassociated my emotions further from FPL. I think what's different now, and I think maybe what makes a bad game week more acute, is the context of COVID, meaning that there are just far less interesting things going on in my life, which means that FPL and the football and enjoying the football and enjoying the FPL matters on a, you know, a scale of importance in my life. It is probably higher than it probably not, you know, healthily should be. And so maybe that makes bad game weeks that bit more acutely painful. And maybe when the overall backdrop to football is so negative and games gone and VAR and da, 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 it kind of makes it a bit more difficult to enjoy it. But at the same time, I'm not kind of devoid of an objective look at this and being like, okay, I'm quite happy with my side. I still have plenty of good players in my side. And so I'm doing my best to limit maybe those external factors that are probably influencing me thinking this game week is bad more so than it was already a bad game week.
Mm. No, absolutely. I mean, Nick, you're fairly sanguine when it comes to FPL game weeks, aren't you? I mean, last week you didn't have that good a week and you weren't particularly talkative. I think that's probably kind of the extent of it. You weren't devastated, were you?
No, I mean, I was frustrated at the time and, you know, I wasn't particularly happy, but I think ultimately everyone feels this way to a certain extent. It is human nature, isn't it, to feel disappointed when things don't work out. We're all essentially competitive beings by instinct. We may claim not to be, but we're all ultimately trying to win this game or achieve as many points as possible and get the best rank at the end of the season. And when things don't work out, you'll naturally feel frustrated, especially considering a lot of managers, especially engaged managers who listen to the pods, will spend quite a significant amount of time trying to do research, trying to pick the best team. You know, it's not a case of like many of their friends who might even have beaten them this week who literally log in 2 minutes, make a change, done, that's it. Quite a lot of engaged managers spend, you know, hours and hours of their week looking at their FPL team, talking about FPL, studying statistics, listening to podcasts. So when it doesn't work out, naturally, you know, you're unhappy, aren't you?
Yeah, it's a little more galling, isn't it?
I think in terms of like the reaction and how to react, I think the best reaction is in terms of just trying to move on quickly, isn't it? Start planning ahead for the next game week, or even if you're that feeling that down, you know, do another hobby, try and find something on TV to entertain you.
Take off painting.
give up FPL, but I mean just like engage yourself in something else.
Take up skateboarding and drinking or smoking, yeah.
Entertain, find some other form of entertainment maybe for at least the short term, at least until you get to the next game week, and then all of a sudden you have a great game week and you refound your Vava room or whatever.
Yeah, just don't be that guy who doesn't say anything if he's had a bad week and then won't shut up if he's had a good one, because that's the lowest of the low in my opinion. Anyway, just to add my 2 cents on this, maybe it's because I've had so many bad weeks by now, but I just don't feel it as much these days. I mean, I guess it's a sense of apathetic distance to some extent, but I just don't feel like I'm kicking every ball and feeling every bit as bad luck as much as I used to, shall we say. Perhaps it's a defense mechanism, perhaps it's just me getting older and I've gone through the motions so many times, you know, that it just feels like I've gone through it all. I've seen it so many times. I've had lots of bad game weeks. I've seen them. I know it gets better. I know it will happen again. And after a while, you kind of think, oh, well, what's the point in expending negative energy when I don't have to? It sounds very zen, but that's just the way it is. I've just seen so many of these bad game weeks. I mean, my girlfriend, yes, folks, I've got one, said to me last night, I bet you had a great weekend on FPL. And I was just like, no, it's been a disaster. And she was like, wow, you know, that's so different, because you used to just be like impossible to talk to. And it's definitely true. Like in the first year, especially, I had quite a few like meltdowns about how FPL was going when I was doing WGTA. Don't get me wrong, like I'm not mentally detached from FPL. As Nick put it, I put a significant amount of time into my FPL through doing this, you know, tweeting, thinking about my team. I still feel nervous before a game week. I still think about transfers and an inordinate amount. Sure, I dream about it at least once a week. But I guess emotionally, you learn how to deal with a bad outcome in a more kind of experienced way. The more you do it, and tools like, I don't know, reframing questions like why did I fail to am I happy with the decision I made also really help, just to give you that mental peace of mind.
I mean, when did you take up yoga?
I took up yoga at the start of this year.
We go, guys. But it's
nothing,
your answer.
Nothing to do with that. I also discovered craft beer this year, which has really helped me. in terms of the reaction, doing nothing and taking stock is always quite useful, especially on a week like this. I mean, I did take mine and say, I know, so it erodes my sort of patient zen sort of pedestal that I'm preaching from. But I mean, with things so crazy, with an international break coming up, it is one of those weeks where, if in doubt, do now. And I don't know. I find it very difficult at the moment to think that any outcome is going to occur with confidence. So off the back of my mind, particularly, I'm probably going to be doing nothing, batting down the hatches. But who knows? Come Friday, I may have given in for the siren call of Vardia rings or something like that. But yeah, I mean, you've got to just, if you have a bad game week, just as I think there is some truth on Nick saying about going off and doing something else, getting your head away from FPL for a bit. Because if you do end up being one of these people who rages and rages and rages, you'll be gone by game week 10. It's a very long season. And if you are feeling this bad in game week 3, you've got to be asking if FPL's a game for you. So we've sandwiched the fluffy stuff in between one bit of statty stuff with the pens. Let's go back to our heartland of the stats. Is there any optimism out there? I mean, it's very topsy-turvy at the moment, isn't it? For example, West Ham went from being finished, you know, relegation candidates after losing 2-1 to Newcastle in game week 1, now 4-0 victors over Wolves in game week 3. I mean, is it all variance? Do we have enough data yet? FPL guidance asked us, in light of poor results for City, Chelsea, Wolves this weekend, should we still treat them the same way, still think we should double up and triple up on them? I mean, Nick, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, these players, these teams aren't going to stop being good teams and good picks overnight, and I think that's probably true. I mean, is there anybody that you've picked up or any stats that you can mention that help answer this question?
We've only had 3 game weeks. Every single game week it feels like there's a new player trending, or one player will have an excellent game week and then all of a sudden drop off the cliff the next game where you've seen it with, like, Son Heung-min, for instance, and you know, Bruno Fernandes, for instance, as well, had a great game week this week, even if he didn't have a great performance. But in terms of the teams, there's a couple of teams certainly that have caught my eye. I mean, one that I'm not going to labour on too much is Liverpool, who obviously they've looked fantastic going forwards, and I've just looked at sort of the latest numbers in terms of the goal attempts after this game week, and they're 17 ahead of any other team for goal attempts. They're 9 ahead of any other team for shots inside the box, for instance. So those sort of stats are proving that Liverpool, once again, are going to be fantastic offensively, even if they've looked slightly defensively suspect so far. But it doesn't matter in terms of those defenders that we all own, because they're getting the attack returns as well. Otherwise, I think the more exciting team, perhaps the one that perhaps caught us a little bit more by surprise this season, is Everton. And, you know, since I've played FPL, Everton have essentially personified underperformance, haven't they? They've always been a team that we've brought in one of these characters in, you know, like sort of Sigurdsson or Walcott or someone, and they've inevitably done absolutely nothing, and we've got rid of them a few weeks later. But this season, it does feel like there's a little bit of a change with Everton. They really, really have had a good start. I think, obviously, they've got a world-class manager in Ancelotti, which is probably doing them massive favours, but they've also signed a huge name in James Rodriguez, which certainly we've seen that in terms of an extra dimension to performances. So far, they're 4 for goal attempts, 42. Interestingly enough, apart from Aston Villa, who, some, you know, freakishly haven't conceded a goal yet, they've got the second best defence as well, surprisingly. They've only conceded 3 goals, but, you know, that just shows how many teams have struggled defensively this season. It seems like it's all about the forwards, all about the penalty takers, not about the defenders, because so many teams have been conceding goals this season. So I think with Everton and Liverpool, they're certainly the teams that caught my eye. But as I said, too early kind of to do too much statistical analysis, very early for the stats, because there's some teams that really throwing some weird anomalies right now. For instance, West Ham and Brighton, they're joint second. They were top before the Liverpool game, but they're joint second for goal attempts with 44 so far. West Ham supposedly meant to be a team in disarray, but the amount of crosses and chances that their defenders are creating for the likes of Suchek and Antonio, they're just, you know, storming the statistics at the moment, aren't they? And it's a bit of a surprise, really, that.
looking at the data, it's going to be quite difficult to gain anything from it, pretty much as Nick has been saying. And no matter, I think, which way you pull the numbers, Everton are going to look good from an attacking perspective. Liverpool still look just fine. Spurs are actually ticking along quite well in terms of stuff like shots in the box, and Harry Kane in particular is. West Ham are actually oddly doing quite well on shots in the box as a statistic as well, but take that as you will. Leicester, for example, their numbers look quite good, but if you consider that they had five pens, you can, you know, take away the numbers and that it doesn't look quite as nice, because three games is such a small amount of games that five shots in the box makes up a pretty big portion of any team's shots in the box. Like, for example, Liverpool have about 35. The data isn't quite in yet because we're so recording just after the game. Yeah, like attack-wise as well, you can also see that the likes of Man United are just not getting in the box enough. They've, in terms of shots in the box per game, they're mid-table at best. City, it's actually the same thing, and Burnley as well. I've adjusted because, of course, they've played less than other teams, and they're just not that impressive. But the eye test told you that already, so the data isn't giving you any sort of deeper insight into any of that.
No, I agree. I think broadly, no, we don't have enough data yet, and I feel like we should almost let the madness be a bit, watch the storm and accept our lack of ability to affect things too much. I mean, you've got teams finding their feet, new personnel too. As you've both noted, you know, Everton, Liverpool broadly look good. Fulham look bad. West Brom can't defend. One thing that we are missing perhaps is a Burnley, Sheffield United or Wolves in terms of, you know, defensive solidity. No Tarkowski for Burnley. Looks like he's trying to force a move of a very, very kind of mysterious toe injury he's refusing to let them have a look at. Sheffield United, Jack O'Connell has a knee injury and he's out for a long time. And Wolves obviously look very bad versus West Ham. I think they're really feeling that Johnny injury as much as they're feeling a Matt Dee's departure. Really interesting watching that West Ham game. And Tim Spears in the Athletic backed this up as well. But the Wolves fullbacks just weren't sinking well. And Bolly and almost and definitely game week one hero Sice were just totally exposed. There's a fab image in the Athletic article on this of how Fornals and Antonio had so much space down the flanks to get into because the Wolves' back three was so narrow and the fullbacks just bombed on. It's something that we didn't really see last season outside of the Project Restart in terms of there being an indisciplined Wolves team. So you expect that to improve. But basically, it feels like it takes a little while just to get the feel of the season, which is why the first three pods for us, this is a very statistical or stats-minded podcast normally, insight driven by data is our sort of tagline. But the first three pods tend to be a bit talkier from us because we haven't quite got the stats yet to kind of go into those sort of heartlands, but we will for next week, I think. Game week four of us, 4 weeks, that's enough to start kind of going on with. I don't know, I haven't called it reversion to the mean, law of averages, or just, you know, quantitative data impact over the course of the last few years. But broadly, better teams are more consistent and some kind of predictability should descend soon. Obviously, it's not completely predictable. We'd all be OR number one. And it's really boring if it is predictable. But put it this way, there's always storms and we don't like to be caught in them. But who doesn't like watching the thunder, lightning and the rain through their window, eh? We just have to just put up with it. I think it's just going to be, at least for one more week, a bit bizarre, and it should settle down before long. I feel like I'm giving weather forecast now, but there you go. So, in summary, how do we make sense of the madness? It seems like pen takers are here to stay. It seems like, in terms of reacting to a poor game week, having a sense of patience, taking yourself away, taking yourself out of it for a little bit before you come back to FPL is a good idea. Absorb it and learn to roll with the punches over time. And is there anybody who's any good? Do we have enough data yet? I mean, there are a few kind of eye test observations we can make, but it's probably going to need a little bit more time just to settle down there. Stick with it. It's a great game and it's very rewarding if you do stick with it for the course of the season. It is just at the moment very difficult to kind of give any clear-eyed idea of what's going to happen. But you know, before long, it will return, hopefully, with a few more penalties to the game that we will enjoy. All right, let's take a break there and move on to the Q&A and correspondence after this.
Who got the assist?
So we're back and it's time to catch up with the Who Got the Assist mini league. As I said earlier, if you want to join the league code is CPSULF. And I'm just going to give a quick roundup of the top five or top six, actually, because there's two people currently joint fifth. And it's worth noting as well that all of the top six, none of them took hits as well. So a lot of managers seemingly happy with their teams, not making too many transfers at the top. And it's worked out quite effectively, actually, for all of these guys. So in joint fifth, it's Brian Magata and Mohamed Moussa. both scoring 239 points in total, 59 points and 65 points respectively for their FPL team. So pretty solid scores all in all. In fourth was Darren Axton. He got 72 points this game. It's just an incredible score, to be honest, for his team, Timmy FC. And I think it was mainly that Vardy pick, as well as sort of a Kane captaincy in Bamford, that kind of worked out for him this game week, as well as Robertson as well in defence. In third, James Dayton stays in third with dyslexia untied. He got 56 points this game week. And then at the top, Hersh Pandya has been knocked off the top spot by he only got 49 points, and the new number one who's climbed up five places is Abid Roshan with Winnie the Kapoo. So he got 67 points this game week, and he's now up to a total of 257 points in total. So having a great week. Again, that Vardy pick really doing wonders for him, as well as a couple of interesting differentials like Mason Mount got him 12 points, and Robertson and Trent in defence as well.
Some solid stuff there. It's almost concerning to hear that, you know, some people are staying in around the top 10 already after this few game weeks. It's like, guys, give us a chance. We want to catch up. But anyway, let's bring us on to everyone's favorite section, the correspondence section. Your chance to give your proper opinion, address something that was said on a previous pod, or to start up a discussion on something close to your heart that you've been using. We have a record number of emails in this week, as I said earlier. So thanks to everyone for getting in touch. It's whogottheassist@gmail.com. Whoa. The record, Tom. Thanks everyone for getting in touch to whogottheassist@gmail.com, and you can send your letter there to get in this next week or the week after that. Anyway, this week's email comes from Shenzhen, China, just showing the global influence and reach of this segment, from listener Danny Lyons, where he begins, "Good morning, gentlemen. Greetings from Shenzhen, China, where we still have warm weather and where we are looking forward to the forthcoming Golden Week holiday. Good luck with that. We hope you enjoy it. I've been a regular listener for a few years now, and I'd like to begin by thanking you for your excellent output over the past years." Now, I've edited out a lot of very kind words from Danny here, just to avoid narcissism, but thank you for those, Danny. I've saved one important bit, though. "I do like the concept of a correspondence segment during the podcast." Thanks, Danny. "Now, would it be possible for you to discuss the statistics around hedging / doubling up? So what's the purpose of hedging? A double return is always good, but whether it's from two players from the same team or two players from different teams, it really doesn't matter. The only reason I can think against hedging is that it may take up more space than when you were looking to include multiple players from a successful team. All the very best. Thanks again for the podcast. I'm thoroughly enjoying your coverage. Danny Lyons." Thanks, Danny. And also, thanks very much to Joe Gruen for sending in an email. It'll probably be next week's correspondence, but anyone else, get your emails in for whogottheassist@gmail.com for more. Lads, thoughts on that question from Danny?
Excellent. Danny, ni hao, ni zhenmiang. So, wo men jue de. I'm not going to go do the whole thing in Chinese. But anyway, I think that...
Whoa! Truly an international segment, folks.
Exactly. This is obviously something that's really interesting to us, just because it's something we've spoken about a fair bit. I know Nick's got some proper like depth stats here, but I'm just going to kind of give voice to something which is the kind of the idea of compound differentials that we've spoken about a few times on the podcast in the past. And that's obviously the owning two players from the same team to deepen the differentiation. So maybe a little bit different from hedging, but in some ways quite effective too, as a way of sort of making sure that you're kind of covering all the bases, as it were. This is very effective, especially in defence. So Liverpool defence, for example, this week, our friend Karam has this, we've got a question from him later. So this year, Trent Alexander-Arnold is the most owned player in the game, 43.8% owned. When he does something, you're not likely to gain much. He's a bit of a hygiene factor. Then you've had him, if you add in a player like Robertson and pair them together, then you have some extra points for you if Liverpool do keep a clean sheet. Only 14.89% own the pair. So that's a compound differential having them both. So the idea is that you have A plus B. That means you've got less people who have that with you. Defensively, it's more likely to kind of to come off because clean sheets are shared by members of a back line. But offensively, you can see that too. So you could hedge and say, right, having lots of fingers in the same offensive pie is a good thing. So, for example, Bruno, Martial, Rashford, Project Restart, having Bruno on his own was a rank killer. We didn't captain him because of how highly owned he was. And short term, that abundance of attacking points was a real boon for us FPL managers because it meant a compound differential of two or three of them was a fantastic idea. And, you know, if you had Bruno, you might as well have had Martial as well, because then you could have had some gain from Man United doing well. Mala, so Mane and Salah in the past would have worked too. The other way around, if you are hedging, So, I don't know, having a goalkeeper as well as the striker in one game from opposite teams, that is. So you can say, well, at least this weekend, for example, I own Chris Wood and I own McCarthy. Hypothetically, you're kind of thinking, well, at least I got a clean sheet out of that. Normal practice for me is to try to avoid that to some extent. And if that does happen, I hope that the lower owned player does something. But yeah, I mean, Nick, what do you think about this? What do you think about hedging? What data have you dredged up?
So it kind of links in a little bit as well with what FBL guidance was asking us in terms of whether we stick with our plans to double and triple up on these teams based on our reputations. And I think ultimately, I always do try and front loads on teams I know that can score plenty. We've seen it a little bit this season. We've sort of managed to get targeted the likes of Everton in game week two. We're celebrating. And we've seen it over the past couple of seasons, triple Liverpool, triple City, etc. Has done very well for managers that have loaded up on those teams. So I looked at my game week one team this season. I did have triple Liverpool and a double Leicester, but that was it in terms of the double ups and the triple ups. And I certainly think with Liverpool, they've proved themselves over the past few seasons that they are a team that you want to front load and hedge as much as possible. On so from a statistical point of view, I did have a quick look at sort of some of the historical teams of the year, I guess, and how they all performed and the makeup of them a little bit as well. There were some really interesting cases, I think. So, for instance, the 16-17 season, it was made up of 4 Chelsea players and 3 Spurs players. So if you spent the entire season tripled up on Chelsea and Spurs, you'd have really done well that season. It was sort of the year of sort of Ali Ericsson and Kane all doing well. And then you got 15-16 as well, another interesting case. So that was the year of Leicester, Arsenal and Spurs when they dominated. So if you had a team of Mahrez, Vardy, Fuchs, Ozil, Bellerin, Cech and Eriksen, Kane and Alderweireld, you'd have done exceptionally well and beaten me, essentially, if you captained one of those guys just based on those players alone, which, you know, was obviously a particularly bad year for me that year, but just shows the power of just finding those right teams and tripling up on them. And I did actually have a look a little bit in terms of defence. So obviously, last season, we know that Liverpool defenders, they were the 3 top scoring defenders. That was the case the year before. And it's actually, it's been every season since 13-14 where there has been 2 defenders out of 3 have been from the same team. So in 19-20, I said the 3 top scoring defenders were Liverpool players. It was the same in 18-19. In 17-18, it was 2 Chelsea players who were the top out of the 3. That was Azpilicueta and Alonso, if you remember. 16-17 was 3 Chelsea players. This was sort of the year of Gary Cahill doing exceptionally well alongside Azpilicueta and Alonso as well. And in 15-16, we go back to Arsenal, which was 2. So Bellerin and also Petr Cech was in goal. So if you include the keeper, that was 3 for them. And Koscielny as well. 14-15, you go back to Chelsea, years of Terry and Ivanovic, and 13-14 was the year of Coleman and Baines, surprisingly, but they were both very attacking fullbacks for Everton and they got quite a few clean sheets. So that kind of proves, I guess, the point of it's too early to see that team at the moment. It's hard to call. It's probably going to be Liverpool again, but just proves the kind of power of doubling up or tripling up in defence and on the same team, just because you can pick those players. If you can find that team that does go on that ridiculous run of clean sheets and also has some attacking returns from the defenders, you can, it really pays off in terms of hedging your bets, I guess, in terms of going for a double up in defence.
Yeah, I guess kind of to round off the section, like, there is always a zombie team that you could have made that would probably have finished in the world number one spot. And, you know, it kind of really does give credence to this idea that you can just, you know, double up on a team that's good defensively or just have multiple attacks from the same team. And obviously, if you pick the right ones, and that's the challenge of FPL all the time, if you're making transfers or whether you're hedging up or if you're having a zombie team, you can do extremely well. And so, no more than everything, it's context dependence and getting it right is important, but hedging, doubling up, it's totally a viable strategy. Anyway, we'll finish off this segment now. Danny, thanks so much for emailing in. whogottheassist@gmail.com if you want to get your correspondence in for next week or the week after that or the week after that. It's an international segment and it's growing in popularity, so I just can't wait to see more emails streaming in. Think of like Harry Potter when all the letters are coming into the house. That's it.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I think we'll get to Joe Bruin's question next week. But I mean, this question next, the first of the Q&A, sort of touches on it anyway. We'll go into more depth because Joe did ask kind of a few more things than that about this. But the first questions are about wildcard timing. So Adagendran asked, with all this madness, should we just be holding on to our wildcard no matter what? And Matthew Derbyshire says, you know, he's working on a target overall score and he's still ahead of where he wants to be. But he's had a diabolical week. He asked us, there's no need to panic, right? Hold my wild card, yeah? What is our view on the wild card? Anthony, you said before we came on that you were maybe getting close to pressing the button, and our friend Chris, Efio Awesomeo, we've just learned has pressed the button, so it is going on. What do you think?
So the thing is, I just feel like I can benefit more by waiting one more week and not being caught out by international break injuries and everything, and COVID, which was a bit of a feature of the last international break as well. If I use my wild card between game week 4 and game week 5, I just feel like I could be setting myself up for failure if I use it right now. And so even though there are definitely fires I would like to put out in my team, like Matt Doherty, for example, I'm now classifying as a fire. I didn't classify him as a fire last week, but he is certainly a flame at this point within my side. There are these issues, but at the same time, if I act now, I'll probably catch myself out, and another week's worth of data, as we were talking about, couldn't do any harm either. So with that in mind, it's like just a little bit more patience seems like it could benefit me more in the long run. And of course, like if I'm wildcarding, that's a 10-week game week decision minimum really that I'd be taking if I do make that. And with that in mind, doing it now is just not the right time.
I'm not considering wildcarding at this particular moment in time. Certainly with the fixtures for my team in the next game week, it looks pretty strong. It looks pretty decent setup. There's no chance this particular game week. I did consider perhaps game week 5, perhaps as the wildcard change, just because there's a little bit of a shift in fixtures for my team. You know, the likes of the Manchester City start to have some really good fixtures, and Leicester's fixtures are a little bit tougher after that, so it might be time to get rid of the likes of Justin, especially if Pereira's coming back. So, I mean, that's potentially when I am looking to consider to wildcard. I certainly think, you know, we've seen in the last couple of game weeks, I guess, some of the early wildcarders punished, and, you know, they got punished severely this week, and they've now also got that added element of the fact that they no longer have that chip in their arsenal as well, and that does concern me. In regards to wildcarding, I'd rather kind of hang on to a chip and then at least I've kind of got it to play with a little bit later on in the season once we do have a few clearer stats, a few more obvious contenders that are players that aren't perhaps just, you know, on a one-week frenzy and are going to be solid picks for the whole season. And obviously as well, I know this is something you've looked at, Tom, separately, but there's also, we've got the blank in game week 18 and the double in game week 19. So it might even be that if I don't find an optimum moment over the course of the season, I just hang on to it as late as possible to try and, you know, give myself an advantage once those blanks and doubles come into play.
Yep, my explicit aim is to get to game week 16 and use my wild card then. That's my explicit aim because of what Nick's just mentioned with that kind of very difficult sort of transition around that time. However, I'm not going to be dogmatic about that. If my team needs it beforehand, I'll do it. I mean, I did take the minus 8 this week to try to preserve that wild card. I'm happy with that decision. I may well do that again. But when I'm looking at, I think we said last week, it's kind of a minus 12. That's the sort of time I will start looking at wild carding. I haven't got that many fires at the moment. In fact, I've probably got not very many. I can kind of figure out like a Martial with a 2-3 transfers over the international break. I prefer to get to game week 16, 100K, having used my wild card and need to take hits rather than being in game week 16, 1 million, having held on to my wild card through thick and thin. I think that you can't get overly into a strategy. Sometimes you've got to be adaptable. If your team's really failing, you need to use that wild card, then use it. But my express aim still is to get to game week 16 and use it then, because it'd be such an interesting and useful tool around them. But I completely understand why, you know, Anthony, you go around game week 4, or, you know, it sounds like Nick's more aligned with me, but you know, whenever you use it, I'm sure you use it for a reason. You're not going to just be pulling it willy-nilly, are you? So yeah, no need to panic would be my view. But if you do feel the time is right, then I don't think we can really criticise that either. So there you go. Right, Next question, defenders of interest. So Isaac Dorgan asks if there's any decent defenders out there at all. He's got Tierney and he wants to replace him for some reason. And Dabby Peace mentions Castagne, who we mentioned earlier on, as looking perfect for that sort of role. What do we think? Are there any defenders who are looking of interest, given the amount of goals that are going in beyond kind of the usual TAA and Robertson? I think Castagne is actually quite a decent shout, isn't he?
Yeah, I think Castagne, he has an excellent start to his Leicester career and he's been seriously involved in those attacks, hasn't he? But I was actually surprised to see that he'd only created 3 chances and he's had 3 assists. So it seems like his sort of attacking output in terms of the underlying stats looks a little bit unsustainable considering what he's produced so far. He has had 8 penalty box touches, which has led to those nice fantasy assists that he has been picking up on the side, of course, by being fouled in the box. But otherwise, I think there's a few other fullbacks really caught my eye. I think Lamptey, he looks like a really, really good shout over the course of the season. Again, he's one that's got 3 assists, despite only creating a couple of chances, getting those fantasy assists from penalties again. But it doesn't really matter. The fact is that he's getting those fantasy assists because he's so forward all the time. He's getting into the box, getting into those dangerous positions. And, you know, I liked Lamptey at the start of the season, but because of Brighton's tougher fixtures, I didn't consider him for my team. But now I think the fixtures are going to start to turn a corner and he's certainly impressed in those opening fixtures at 4.5. He's someone that is strongly on my radar. Otherwise, you've also got Reece James, of course. Fantastic. He scored, it's just such a weird stat that he scored 0 points last game week, but still managed to pick up a bonus point. I don't think that's ever happened in the FPL before, and certainly no one's asked the question, no one brought up another player that's ever managed to achieve that, so it's a record there. But he created 6 chances, which is more than any other player this game week. Has had 30 crosses as well, so most of the league so far. Certainly a player that is on my radar, again, in terms of defenders. And I'd also give a shout out to my man Luca Dean, another player that's doing very well in terms of creating chances. Again, I know that Everton look a bit shaky defensively, but it seems to be the case for every single FPL team right now, doesn't it? And that stat that they've actually conceded the least goals bar Aston Villa is perhaps testament to the fact that they're not as shaky as we all think they are.
Yeah, okay, Nick, I get all those. I think I completely agree with them, so I'm not going to go over them again. I think just to throw a few kind of cheaper players into the mix, perhaps. I mean, at the moment, the stats are a little bit up and down. But in terms of the eye test, I think one guy, I mean, I own Luke Ayling, but watching the Leeds game, I think that Stuart Dallas definitely was a lot more attacking as FPL stag. Don't know who he is, some random bozo, but he wrote that in the Fantasy Hub that he was perhaps a little bit better than anything in terms of going forward. And he certainly seems to be doing very well in the underlying stats. And I'm not going to cite them because it was only a 3-game week, so what's the point? So a couple of other people to just mention quickly. Adam Webster, so everyone's been going on about Lamptey. But I noticed from the eye test again that he was the man who was the main set piece threat. I mentioned in the last pod with late riser that that's the sort of thing that we look for amongst the cheap players, or at least I look for. And he was the one that all of the set pieces were looking for, either for the knockdown or just kind of being the main target. He was also the highest scoring player last season, who was a 4.5 million defender this season. So I'd be very interested in him going forward. Looks like he'll play 38 out of 38. And in the same vein, Concert. They're looking very, very defensively solid. And of course, top of that, you know, Castagne, Reece James, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think, Anthony?
Honestly, you guys have pulled out all the interesting players. And I think what's most interesting to me about the defenders is the fact that pretty much already, in terms of defensive solidity, you couldn't say Liverpool are bad. And in terms of attacking returns and attacking prowess and attacking underlying stats, the three big names, Van Dijk, Robertson, and Trent Alexander-Arnold, are already starting to, you know, stick out from the pack to some extent. And so I guess it shows that the Liverpool double up in defence isn't necessarily dead whatsoever. And I think if you were wildcarding this week, or certainly when I'm wildcarding, presumably in a week's time, I think it will definitely be something that's I wouldn't be ruling out doing, just purely because they're just going to return those points all the way through the season. I think it leads into really another question that we've had from Radiohead Tim on value weighting. What his question really gets at is just, what is value? And the fact of the matter is that, like, there aren't very many attackers who are, let's say, 6 million and over, or who are going to be outscored by any of the forwards over the season, Patrick Bamford included, who has had a brilliant start to his time in the Premier League with Leeds. But the fact of the matter is that, is what he's doing sustainable? it's questionable at least. And what we do know is that the likes of Robertson and TAA have that long-term pedigree that you could kind of rely on, that if you were building a wildcard team that, as I said earlier, you're looking at 10 weeks into the future, you can put them in there and you'll know that they're going to probably return your points. They'll get a few clean sheets along the way and you'll probably be smiling at the end. Whereas with Bamford, you might be buckling yourself up for a bit of frustration.
Certainly, I think that answered that question pretty well, actually. So let's move on to Sonny's time up. Karam Tizer, who asked, I thought, on Son replacements, because obviously Son looks like he got hooked at halftime. Looks like he's got an injury according to Mourinho, and obviously a lot of people have been selling him. We've got some indication from Market Forces, don't we, Nick, where people are going. But, I mean, if you own Son, what would you be doing?
No real sort of standout pickers there in terms of the replacements right now, especially around that price point. It's a bit of an awkward price point, 9.1 million. So you'd probably be looking to downgrade. So I think certainly if you've got a little bit of excess cash in the bank, Bruno would be someone that would be perhaps on the radar. But I think for me, perhaps the main person I'd probably suggest is it's a little bit of a sort of a left field pick, maybe, maybe not. But I'd actually quite consider Riyad Mahrez at Manchester City. I think, you know, he's 8.4, so he's a similar price point. With Sterling, with Aguero and Jesus both injured, yeah, Mahrez is probably going to start week in, week out, at least for the next few. So I think, you know, and he did pretty well as well in that opening game, his first game of the season against Leicester, where he picked up a goal and assist. So I think certainly he will he'll be in Pep's plans and could easily get you some decent returns. So he's perhaps the main one. I think the other two, we saw them in the Market Forces, the UEFA Quick Shout would probably be Zaha and James Rodriguez, perhaps as two other picks. But Mahrez would probably be the one that I would suggest.
Yeah, I think Nick's really kind of captured the overall state of things there. I think Trossard just is an interesting differential you could throw in as well. Hit the post, I don't know how many times at the weekend, and is just always seems to be quite good on the underlying stats, does get the returns, and is only 6 million, so you could save up funds for elsewhere. I guess on the topic of Spurs, and maybe just to throw it in, is that I think Harry Kane is kind of a bit of a sleeper option there that people aren't looking at because he's only scored once. And like the fact of the matter is he is a penalty taker, but we haven't necessarily seen him profit from that status like the likes of Jamie Vardy have so far. But he's actually third for non-pen XG in the league behind Calvert-Lewin, of course, and Lacazette, which is a bit more of a lull, I guess. So I think if you were getting out of Spurs in the form of Son, I think you should definitely be looking to get Kane in, just to, not so much to cover yourself, but more because he's almost their main, only attacking outlet in the current circumstances until at least Gareth Bale returns from injury.
Maybe. I think if it is just a straight swap, though, I'm not sure I'd be going to Lucas Moura or something like that.
No, it's go to Kane. Don't bother with the rest of them in the middle.
Yeah, that makes sense. No, I agree with those recommendations. I think the only one I want to throw in here is maybe Harvey Barnes, just because they've got two pretty good games against Double Clarets coming up. West Ham, Aston Villa, isn't it? And you know, he's statting fairly well. And the only time I use stats here, I suppose. So he's had the third most shots. Most shots on target, the second most shots in the box, and his XG is about Civ. So he's started the season pretty damn well. If you don't own Vardy as well, he could be a really nice sort of Riker pick, a foil to him. It looks like sort of those points are coming at the very least. He's a fifth as well on Fantasy Football Hub's expected points stat. So he'd be one that I'd be interested in, at least in the midfield, that is.
And if you're a fan of serious Schadenfreude and believe in it, then Bruno Fernandes, 10.5 million, coming up against Spurs next. Penalty taker, just to annoy Mr. Jose Mourinho. Wouldn't be surprised if
he scored a penalty in the restart, don't forget. That was the first game back, he scored a penalty.
Yes, yeah, and it would be pretty funny to find Bruno Fernandes nailing a penalty just to drive Mourinho crazy. And it could happen. It could very well happen.
It could happen indeed. I remember that I removed him on my free hit. And he scored a penalty, and I was very, very... I wasn't upset at all. I was like, oh, that's always going to happen. Right, okay, next
question. You were doing the yoga at that point, or on the craft beer at that stage.
I think I was on the beer rather than doing yoga. Right, okay, next question. Werner / Martial replacement. So Andrew Helmstetter and FPL O'Heary ask, what are we doing with Martial and or Werner? So they've noted that I own Martial, and Nick owns Werner. Anthony, do you own either? Werner?
Werner.
So what are we doing with these guys? Obviously, there's a lot of market activity around them, a bit of a fire sale, truth be told, and both dropped in price. So what are we doing, those two guys ask? Anthony, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I guess I've already outlined the allure of Kane, and so if you haven't got Harry Kane on your side, there's easy straight swap there at 10.5 mil. Just find a little bit more bank and
find a million out of nowhere, guys.
Yeah, just find a little bit more bank and off you go with a pretty good striker there in Harry Kane. Of course, coming up against United next, whose defence hasn't exactly been all that impressive so far. Whilst Calvert-Lewin is seemingly definitely the better pick so far, Richarlison's underlying stats remain quite good, and doubling up on Everton, as ridiculous as it might sound, it might have sounded a few weeks ago, doesn't sound like a bad option now. And then there is, of course, Raúl Jiménez. We were talking about that. Fulham coming up next means that you'd have to consider him just because of that. You'd be nuts not to. And of course, look, he's shown us over years that we can expect good performances from him, and he was the postman for so long, and I expect him to return to that role quite soon. Danny Ings as well, West Brom next.
Yeah, I was gonna say, for me, I think it's a choice between Ings and Jimenez, isn't it? So
game week one all over again.
It's targeting teams again as well. So Ings has West Brom at home, who've conceded 11, Fulham conceded 10, Jimenez says Fulham at home. Ideally, I'd want both, to be honest, if I could. And certainly, like, I'm flitting between the two. I was kind of thinking about Jimenez. Now I'm starting to think about Danny Ings again, because Danny Ings seems to have the form perhaps a little bit more compared to Jimenez. So he might be the one that I end up going with, and then hope to cover walls with Podence if he's fit. So it might be Ings that I end up going with. But I think those two are perhaps the key men that I'd pull out. And I'd probably suggest those as the two picks ahead of you know, these kind of hipster picks of Calvert-Lewin and Bamford that seem to be floating around a little bit as well.
Anything to avoid getting Paddy in your team, ain't it?
Hipster pick, Dominic Calvert-Lewin, top scorer in the Premier League.
The only man to have risen 0.4. Yeah, okay. So on this one then, guys, I was looking at it actually. I own Martial, these guys own Werner. And I was looking at it on Saturday night. He was about to drop, and I even got as far as the confirm screen, Martial to Ings, and I had a few beers, you know. But for some reason, this sort of lucidity came over me that it was probably better to have 2 free transfers at the end during international break, when everything goes all COVID mad, than to do a mid game week transfer for the sake of 0.1. So I left it. He's now down to 8.9. I feel like the sunk cost fallacy has kicked in, where I feel like, well, I've lost that money now, I'm never going to recover that, so I might as well just keep going and roll the transfer. Yeah, all right. This week, I'm absolutely petrified of Mr. Ings against West Brom, and I'm also fairly petrified that Vardy's going to start a streak. But the thing is, and there's that Kane fella, but you know, he plays in defensive midfield, right? But I mean, the thing is that I think it's better to have 2 free transfers to enable me to do like a real wholesale change after the international break with all that information. And I think that at the moment I'm going to be leaving Martial in, just because he's the kind of guy who can go from one week being totally not asked to the next week being the superstar who gets a brace out of nowhere. So I'm going to be hoping that's true and leaving it for the time being. But yeah, I mean, I can understand people are selling. I can understand why you guys are both potentially looking at selling Werner. I wouldn't be surprised when it comes to transfers and captains. If you've turned around and gone, yeah, I've got rid of him already, especially for Jimenez, who I already own. If you don't own Everton striker, Richarlison or DCL, I understand that. Probably worth doing, but I already own Richarlison. But yeah, me owning Jimenez probably means that you guys are both buying in Jimenez. I already have him, so that's quite nice for me that I can then roll the transfer, whereas you guys over the international break will not be able to roll the transfer. So swings
at roundabouts. I'll be using my wild card.
Oh yeah, true, but I'll have my wild card in situ, you know. There's swings at roundabouts, as they say. And the final thing, a matter of time. FPL Dempsey asks, are we finding the fixtures across the weekend adds to our enjoyment of FPL, or causes unnecessary decision fatigue or overthinking as things happen? So I think this is actually quite an interesting question, because I mean, I'm in a few DM groups, and I watch FPL Twitter, and obviously we've got our little kind of Slack that we keep alluding to, and it's really interesting, not so much on our Slack, but on FPL Twitter and in the FPL DM groups, to just see the wind shaking.
Bastions of logic, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. The weather vane just moves from side to side throughout about the game week. You know, if you have everybody on one player during the game week, this other guy scores and suddenly they're all on that player and they completely ignore the first kind of thing. It is absolutely fascinating to see how it changes. It really is. And I think that it is probably a product of the fact that we're seeing these fixtures in a staggered formation and each game gets its own sort of individual sense of analysis and evaluation, which you don't quite get when all the games are together at the 3 p.m. And to that extent, I do think it causes at least a sense of decision fatigue and overthinking, because the amount of 180s I've seen, be it in a group chat or be it on a Twitter account saying I've, you know, I'm definitely doing this, and then kind of 4 hours later tweeting, oh yeah, no, I've done this now. It times up number I've seen. I'm not blaming anybody. It does happen. It's just a fact of life. If you put your opinion out there, nothing wrong with it. I've done it many a time. But it is incredible, really. And I think it is kind of the product of the spread of the fixtures on the weekend. The fact is that I don't look at my, as a rule, I don't look at my rank during the week. And I do obviously look at my points, but I just don't look at my rank, or if I don't look at it, I don't really kind of take it to heart, because it doesn't matter. And at the end of the end is what counts. And at the end is when you start kind of making, for me at least, decisions or conclusions around what I've seen. There's no point in the first game week going, I really want that guy, my god, he scored. And then by the second game, you're like, oh, this guy's also scored. Maybe I want him. Having a running commentary, yeah, fair enough. It makes sense, but it's just not for me. I'm more of the school of, if I've got nothing constructive to say, I'm going to say nothing until I've got something constructive to say. What do you guys think about this? Has the rolling fixtures changed and impacted your decision fatigue, such overthinking?
Ultimately, it has like extended our sort of weekends a little bit in terms of the football, because it's not the case that, oh, okay, you know, you've got a bunch of games going on at 3 p.m. on a Saturday. You might have a couple of live games on a Sunday and, you know, a couple of other live games perhaps on the Saturday, and that's basically it. Right now it's kind of like, you know, the games start at midday and you know, they're going on until sort of 9 o'clock at night, and you know, it's over the course of 3 days and you've got all these live games, and it's quite wearing, and it does kind of, you know, you see a lot of people stressing out saying, you know, I've had a terrible game week, when in fact they've only actually had four of their assets play so far, and it's just because someone that they don't own has gone and scored a hat trick or something along those lines. And you know, I'm guilty of it as well, when I was having my breakdown over Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Everton assets at the beginning of game week two, which ended up being a very bad game week for me. But you know, I think ultimately it does add to the enjoyment, of course, you know, because everyone's having lots of fun watching all the football and getting lots of fun. But then, you know, I think it does kind of, again, you know, Dempsey's got it right, it does both basically. It does cause enjoyment, but does also create a little bit of decision fatigue as well, and overthinking and over analysis perhaps.
Yeah, maybe just to kind of add on to it, like there is an element for me that I do know that we've had one zoomed out talking about our conversation about FPL already, and I kind of took a very negative view on like the world around us and everything, the context within which the games are happening. And I think that definitely affects what's going on as much as the fact that the fixtures are spread out. But it does lead to a football fatigue, but also a football discourse fatigue. Like this weekend, especially, just the drawn out crescendo about penalties genuinely just drove me off Twitter for most of Sunday, because I just couldn't bear to watch it anymore. And I would say as well that there are a lot more tepid takes coming out of people during games, and Tom's alluded to this a bit, but some of these can be extremely daft based on the wide array of eye tests, some from more practiced eyes than others. And I think it means that if you were using just Twitter and opinion as a way to kind of gauge warmth towards a player or something, it's much harder to do that. And maybe this kind of lends an insight into me placing too much weight on just the overall like feeling in the community towards a player, and whether I should be, you know, considering them extra hard. And like, I'm not taking this from the point of view of I don't want to miss out, but it's more just like I have to make sure that I'm not going to miss out because I'm blocking out some player because of whatever stats I've looked at that these people are taking some other conclusion about. So it's like, does it add to my FPL enjoyment? Yes and no. Like, there's absolutely so much more to get from it, because I feel like I can, if you have a good eye, and I don't know if I do, but if you feel like you have a good eye for picking something out from watching games and having a better opportunity to watch more games, then you definitely can get much more satisfaction from something going right for your FPL team. Whereas there are, of course, still so much just unnecessary information kind of being plugged into the mind that it can cause a fatigue over time.
Exactly. I think it just kind of adds to the onus upon you as being a discerning consumer of information. I think that's basically the watchword, isn't it? But
yeah,
there are a lot more opinions because there's a lot more focus on a particular fixture in isolation, and that continues 10 times per game week. And then it's just the case of kind of, for some things, identifying them as just being kind of irrational anger. Fair enough, just leave that be. But there are a few kind of great places, and you find them for yourself. I'm not going to recommend anybody that you think, oh, okay, I agree with that, or at least that's very useful. That challenges my view, or that helps me kind of analyze my view, evaluate my view, put it in context. And as I said, it's just about you being a conscientious and discerning consumer of information. Hopefully by listening to this podcast, you think that our views are very useful for that. Right, okay, let's move on to the transfers and captains. And in terms of being a discerning consumer, or at least a discerning listener, you probably would have intuited that I'm leaving my team this week. The only thing that I'm going to be kind of weighing up is whether I captain Jimenez against Fulham or whether I captain De Bruyne against Leeds. I think both games are going to be a bit mad. Obviously, Jimenez is not particularly noted for being explosive, but I mean, if he's going to score his multi-return week of the season, it's probably going to be at Fulham, isn't it? But that Man City Leeds, Bielsa versus Guardiola, Padawan versus Master could be an absolute explosion of goals. It could be easily a 5-4 or something like that. So you probably back KDB to be involved. I don't know yet. Jimenez feels like a 9-pointer at least is just guaranteed, so maybe I'll be looking at that. And Christ knows, by the fact of how mad the season has been, I wouldn't be shocked if Leeds Man City was 0-0. So there you go. Right, what have you guys done with Werner then? Anthony?
I've done nothing so far, but I'm kind of weighing up that Ings Jimenez one of the two, and that's probably all that's going to happen for me. It'll be either Ings or Jimenez in for Werner, although I do wonder if just the way the season has gone, maybe going back to that idea, that is this the week that by selling Werner he goes off and gets a brace against Crystal Palace, who haven't been, you know, all that interesting, like all that brilliant in defence, in spite of having, I guess, a victory against United. I wouldn't necessarily rule out the chance of Werner suddenly finding the net there. That's it. De Bruyne a captain against Leeds seems like the simple option. If I brought in Ings, I think I would be considering him. I don't think I'd captain Jimenez if I brought him in.
Yeah, I think for me, as I said, it's the same scenario, same Werner. I haven't done any moves yet. I've actually got a couple of yellow flags in the team in Podence and Vardy, so I'm probably just going to hopefully hear that those guys are fit and raring to go, and then I'll make a move. So it's probably going to be Werner out for Ings or Jimenez. Not sure which at the moment. I did actually have the armband on Salah, but I'm starting to rethink that a little bit, considering Aston Villa haven't conceded yet and seem to be ridiculously defensively solid so far. So I might have to consider that captaincy, and maybe I'll put it on De Bruyne, or maybe even one of the guys that comes into the team, Ings and Jimenez. Something I don't really like doing, you bringing in the player and giving them the armband straight away, but I might consider it. So very much up in the air in terms of my captain, haven't picked for certain, and my transfer stood up in the air as well. So inconclusive. Just to say who we are, of course, we are Who Got the Assist. Thanks very much, guys, for listening. If you're a new listener and enjoyed the pod, make sure to hit that subscribe button and give us a review on iTunes if you enjoyed it as well. Really appreciate a 5-star review.
Yeah, review would be absolutely brilliant. If you want to join the Mini League, if you're not in it already, the code is CPSULF. We'll be back next week when hopefully things will be an awful lot better. And we will also have a correspondence section then. So get your correspondence into whogottheassist@gmail.com.
Yep, thanks very much. We hope we assisted make sense of the madness. Good luck in game week 4. Hopefully it will be better for everybody, ourselves included, and speak to you next week, hopefully in a more jubilant fashion. Goodbye.
See ya.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.